from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. In her new book, You Never Forget Your First, historian Alexis Coe offers a fresh look at a president many Americans think they know well, George Washington. Coe found that biographies of Washington were almost all written by men and present some ideas as facts despite a lack of evidence in historical records. She set out to tell a more accurate and nuanced story that also looks at the role women played in Washington's life. We'll talk to Coe about her new book, You Never Forget Your First, and why the truth about Washington matters today. Join us next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. George Washington is among the most well-known of U.S. presidents. After all, he was the first, but presidential historian Alexis Coe noticed that of the hundreds of biographies of Washington, nearly all were written by men, and many repeated unfounding narratives about his personal and political life. So she decided to tell a more nuanced story, to challenge well-worn inaccuracies, re-examine original sources, and look at the women in Washington's life, who she says are misrepresented in the historical record. Coe is contributor to The New Yorker and The New York Times, among other publications, and her first book, 2014's Alice and Frida Forever, A Murder in Memphis, is being made into a movie. Joining me now to talk about her new book, You Never Forget Your First, and why the truth about George Washington matters today, is Alexis Coe. And welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
I guess the place to begin is sort of you're taking on this traditional, well, historical record, we could call it, by so many biographers, almost all of them men, and making us see Washington in a different light. It's true that he was not a great general, that he certainly told a number of lies as opposed to never telling a lie, but I just found your whole approach to him kind of myth-busting and revisionist, heretical even.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, it's funny. It doesn't seem radical to me because it adheres to everything that I have been taught as a historian and I have practiced in my career. First day of grad school, they tell you do not quote other secondary sources. Always check a primary source when you quote it. And what I found was that simply hadn't happened with these hundreds of biographers, and instead that they had taken a very gendered approach in which they were very impressed with military endeavors and they really needed men to have defined Washington's life, even if men were completely absent because, say, he was raised by a single mother or were, you know, sort of came in and out like uncles or half-brothers or these sorts of people. And they also needed him to have a redemption story at the end. It just all seemed to follow a format, almost an outline that someone had handed down rather than what was in the archives.
Well, let's talk a bit about his mother because, of course, Bill Clinton and Barack Obama were also raised by single mothers. But these were quite different for Washington. First of all, his mother was an indentured servant, and the picture of her is, well, pretty bossy and overbearing and all the rest of that. What you found was quite different.
I mean, that's an amazing story, right? She was born to an indentured servant who married well and had Mary. And then Mary was orphaned when she was just a girl. And she also married somewhat well, Augustine Washington, Washington's father. But we don't hear that story about her, you know, widowed at 35, decided not to remarry in order to prioritize her children. What we hear is that she thwarted him at every turn and that, you know, Washington was always trying to escape and go to his half-brother House Lawrence. And the way that she's described, for example, by Ron Chernow is they're words that I wouldn't use, by the way, to describe any subject, but he uses these and I name 30 or 40. You know, I have a big chart, but for example, whining, unlettered, shrewish, demanding, feisty, crusty. And let's stop here at illiterate. Now, Chernow says that Mary Washington is illiterate. It's true she wasn't educated in a school, as few women from that time were, and certainly considering how young she was orphaned, she wasn't the recipient of many novels. But we have letters in her hand. We have books that she owned. So she was literate. And so it's an odd thing. And there's a whole lot wrapped up in even the concept of calling someone an illiterate. It's a place of power. But she wasn't. And so we start there at this very basic myth. And then we have to look at ways situations have been interpreted and also, you know, conclusions about who are we protecting here? Are we protecting the primary sources? Or are we protecting Washington? There is this inherent defensiveness around him.
Well, you take on Ron Chernow, who, of course, was responsible for Lynn Miranda Hamilton and who is a major name in terms of biographies. But the picture we get from you is not that his mother, for example, thwarted him in terms of a military career. She helped turn him into a surveyor instead of what he would have been, which would have been a ranking, low-ranking midshipman.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, for the record, I think Chernow is a wonderful writer, and there's a reason people like to read his books. He's just not always grounded in reality when it's something he's not curious about. And so this is sort of the first, you know, offense by Mary that's presented, not just by Chernow, but by all the biographers, so the ones that came before Chernow, and he just repeated this story. And it's that, you know, Washington's brother, Lawrence, had been an officer in the Navy, the British Royal Navy, of course, and had decided to spring, he says, Washington from his home and you know, sets up this whole campaign to get him to join the Navy. This is how Chernow tells it. And Mary at first is okay, and then she decides, no, I need him here. I don't want to do this. I don't see the advantage for me. And that's it. Like, she thwarted him. And Chernow makes very dramatic statements about this, how this was the first time that she put herself in front of her son's own needs, and that, you know, if he wasn't in her immediate service, she attempted to stop it. And that's sort of an amazing read that's devoid from anything we know about early motherhood, about the Navy, about Lawrence's own letters home from the Navy. He had been an officer. Washington, as you said, would have been a midshipman, so the lowest ranking. Washington was also 14 years old. So any mother of 14 would, you know, be a little bit cautious about this trajectory. But the there was no upward mobility. The survival rate was low. It was not a good opportunity. So instead, she said, look, Washington, he likes the outdoors. He's good at math. His late father, who he's curious about, was a surveyor. Why don't I give him these surveying tools and set him off to do that? And in fact, Washington at 17 becomes the youngest surveyor. And at 18, he owns thousands of acres of land. So so she really set him on an excellent path. And that land, by the way, would grow in value and help Washington be one of the richest men in America.
Talking with Alexis Coe, she's a presidential historian. She's the author of a book called You Never Forget Your First. It's a new biography of George Washington, and we want to talk with her not only about George Washington, the father of our country's relationship with women, but also with slaves, and that's a very different kind of story, perhaps, than the one you were led to by other biographers. It usually has a redemption story behind it, but the real story is one of contrast. Before we get to all of that with you, Alexis Coe, I'm interested in talking with you a little bit about just some facts that have been maybe misappropriated. I even talk about Washington's physical appearance, which has been sort of distorted by many of his previous biographers. He really didn't want to go to war with the Brits. Let's begin there. He essentially wanted to stay with Martha and the dog that he named Sweet Lips, which may show a slightly less, shall we say, strongly masculine side of George Washington, as opposed to that physical picture we get of him always with the thighs. And he didn't have wooden teeth, by the way, just so listeners know that. I mean, you do sort of give us a whole different perspective of this, in many ways, extraordinary man. I mean, no getting around it. But he was really also pressured to be president. We know that he didn't want to be king, but the founders sort of moved him in that direction and really pushed him pretty hard.
Yeah, I think going back to his body, it is remarkable. It survived so many diseases. He was strong. He was determined. You know, during the French and Indian War, when he's fighting for the British, he is riding with a pillow underneath his butt because he's had a terrible case of dysentery. So I am interested in the way that his body functions in that way and how it helps him at 6'2". You know, the gracefulness that he has, the athleticism, how that really impresses the rest of the founders. But I'm not just less interested in it as an object. You know, his biographers have, they all begin their biographies by saying, he's too marble to be real, we're going to break him out. And then they spend, you know, pages upon pages just talking about his amazing thighs, for example. And that doesn't help us break him out. You know, it doesn't tell us something about why his body is impressive. And so I really wanted us to understand his body in order to understand something that's impossible to describe, and is maybe why these biographers have spent so much time on it. We can't describe it about someone we met, you know, at a party on Saturday night. He was charismatic. You know, everyone, they just wanted to be around him. They wanted to they felt like he was a born leader. And the thing about Washington is he was reluctant to leave home always, but he was especially reluctant to go to war with the British. And it's really important to remember that this was a decades-long process, that he felt like he had appealed to them in every way possible, whether it was through letters, whether it was through, you know, changing his businesses, changing vendors, you know, anything that he could think to do, and then he finally rebelled. But these were, you know, big plantation owners. This isn't a bunch of you know, we're not looking at protesters here on a college campus. These are men who were unlikely to cause an issue or to leave their businesses unattended unless they felt like it was really the only way to move forward. And after he gave up power, which he's remarked upon, the world is amazed at this. You know, this is a time of monarchs, kings, and, you know, occasionally a military. We're not that far away from Napoleon. He's pretty close in the future. He's nearby. And so it's amazing that he gives up power. He goes back to Mount Vernon. He's concerned what's going on with the Articles of Confederation. He's concerned about the ways in which debts are not being repaid to foreign countries who helped us finance this war, that it's amazing that we won. But he doesn't want to leave home again. And he also doesn't want the country to depend on him. He already won the war. So if he becomes president, it makes him too central to the story. He's quite satisfied. He was really ambitious as a young man, but now he's satisfied. He's done the unthinkable. But basically all the founders go on a letter writing campaign. Madison even, you know, skips out on his own family Christmas to spend it with Washington. And they convince him to go to the presidency, to go accept he doesn't run, but there's no one else really who is a serious contender. He's unanimously elected, and he calls the trip from Mount Vernon to Washington, the first place that the president lived, to that inauguration, going to his funeral.
It's pretty strong stuff, and I give you a lot of credit for actually giving us new information and allowing us to see Washington in so many different lights, ultimately many good lights. But when it comes to the redemption stories that you see in other biographers' picture of Washington, that is freeing all the slaves, it just is not factual. As you point out in your book, Lafayette went to a great deal of trouble proposing ways to Washington where he could free the slaves, but he only freed one man, Billy Lee, and that was his right-hand man in the Revolution. There were 123 slaves who were still slaves at his death.
Yes. Yeah, so the way that the story goes, this is the Chernow, Ellis, all these men, this is their story. And Mount Vernon has made a lot of strides, but they're still not great on this. And I spent the night there. I gave a talk there. And they're really evolving as an institution. But, you know, Monticello is the model and they're not quite there yet. The story goes, Washington had a change of heart during the Revolution and emancipated his enslaved people, the hundreds you named, in his will. That's not the whole story. Washington, during the Revolution, had thought about selling his slaves, but he didn't want to be responsible for that. He did want to get rid of slaves, but he didn't want to lose any money. And so what he did was he would get these letters from Lafayette, and he wasn't the only one, Lawrence, other people who would say, you know, here you could start a farm where they're tenant farmers. You could do this, you could do that. And he would say, you know, you're so sweet, but, you know, let's talk about this another time. I think gradual is the way to go. And he had other models like Benjamin Franklin. He also had a genuine change of heart, and he emancipated his slaves during his lifetime. And I think that's significant. What Washington did was, you know, he talked a lot about not wanting to see families separated, even though his enslaved population had married Martha's enslaved population. So she had slaves from a previous marriage.
She had about 300 slaves, in fact, didn't she?
She had quite a few. And, you know, those numbers ebbed and flowed over the years. But the point is, hundreds of people had married and had children. And so they had families. So if he didn't want families to be split apart, you know, that should have been a thought from the beginning. But he wanted children were maximizing your profit, right? That's more people to own. So it was a good thing for the slaves to marry. So what happened was one man in his will is freed outright. And outright means right away, without conditions.
That was Billy Lee.
Right, William Lee. And then everyone else was freed that Washington owned. So not Martha's slaves and not slaves that they owned together during their marriage. Those were under Martha's discretion. They did not receive their freedom. Martha had the choice, and I'm not convinced she even knew about this. They would either be emancipated upon her death so that she could utilize them as a resource, you know, to keep the plantation going, their forced labor camp, Mount Vernon, or Martha could set them free. And guess what? Washington had his will published because he wanted people to know what he had done. And that means that hundreds of people who lived on Mount Vernon who were enslaved knew that Martha's life stood between them and their freedom. And she lived the next year of her life because he didn't know, Washington didn't know she could live a year, she could live 10. She lived the next year of her life in fear. We know this from Abigail Adams' letters. We know from Bushrod Washington, Washington's nephew, who is a Supreme Court justice. He was called because Martha was afraid that they were going to burn down her house. And she signs the letter of manumission, and then she dies a year later. And, of course, families are split up anyway.
And Washington also demanded military promotions and caused an international incident. Talk about that in his career.
Yes. Washington, when he was a young man, because he struggled, and we do accept this story with Barack Obama and Bill Clinton, and we don't talk about it a lot, but Ford and Andrew Jackson were also raised by single mothers. Jefferson's mother died, his father died at 14. You know, he's not the only founder, but, you know, it'd be interesting to talk more about that and why we don't look at Washington in this way. But because he at times couldn't feed his horse, you know, that he knew real deprivation when he was growing up. He was really ambitious, and he wanted what he saw his half-brother, who had been from the first marriage and gotten everything, gotten education, gotten the best land, you know, sort of inherited everything from their father's estate. He had a model, and he knew he wanted to be big. He wanted to be famous. He wanted people's respect, and he wanted to be wealthy. And the way to do that for someone like him, a second son from a second marriage, was to join the service. But of course, he was paid less and could not receive an official commission or high commission from the British military because he was a colonist. He was born in the colonies, so he was a second-class citizen. And he tried everything. You know, he did well. He would volunteer. They kept calling him back for service. And a part of it was that he had become famous, and it's funny under the circumstances, darkly funny, because it's for starting a war, basically. Washington was sent into the Ohios by the Virginian governor, Dinwiddie, to check out whether the French were trying to take land that the British had staked out, you know, because America, like, of course, there are Indians there, but we don't care about that. We're trying to get all the land from other foreign countries. Spain's there. It's, you know, everyone's just grabbing territory. And Washington is on a fact-finding mission that turns quickly into everyone's a little trigger-happy, and a diplomat, Jumonville, is assassinated. Washington tells his boss, this Dinwiddie, after he complains, by the way, for pages about not getting equal treatment or better pay. So he spends, you know, pages complaining about his pay, and then he gets to the fact that he assassinated a diplomat. He turns over his journal to Dinwiddie when he gets back to Virginia, to Alexandria. And Dinwiddie, to use this as you know, material for Parliament, he has it published in the colonies, and then it goes abroad, and he becomes this really famous colonist, not only because it's an incredible story of this international incident, and the British use it to defend the fact that they're now in the 7 Years' War, the Indian and French War, but that it's like an adventure story. You know, people in London are not going to come to the Americas, to the colonies, and they're not going to, you know, go into the great outdoors and deal with all these amazing and scary you know, circumstances. And so he became this larger in life character in his early 20s, but that does not mean that they were going to make him equal to British subjects. And so eventually he finds his retirement plan in his late 20s by the name of Martha Custis, a rich widow.
And we're talking with presidential historian Alexis Coe. She's the author of You Never Forget Your First, a new biography of George Washington, who, of course, celebrated actual birthday was February 22nd, father of our country, actually my father's birthday also. And we're going to give you an opportunity to speak with our guest about the man who has been designated and often described as and continues to be described as the father of our country. Want to hear your thoughts and any questions or comments you might have, and you can call us now at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786, or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions you might have to forum@kqed.org. Some emails coming in here. Here's Paul, who writes, Alexis Coe, I'm about to finish the Chernow biography, he writes. One thing your guests are seeming to avoid is the fact that Washington really disliked his mother.
We don't know that. That's the thing, is we don't – what we don't consider is that on some days Washington seems really annoyed on the page with his mother, and on other days he does not. He is almost excited to tell her things because they're real people who were living out dynamics we're all familiar with, which is that sometimes you have tension with your parents and sometimes you don't. You know, at times – she writes loving letters as well. You know, Chernow says that she was lacked all maternal warmth. One of the last letters she sent to him, she had missed a visit during the Revolution. She hadn't seen him in 7 years. And it's heartbreaking. She says, you know, I'm never going to see you again. I love you. And for a mother of her time period, that is quite a profound statement. We hardly ever see that from Abigail Adams, but nobody judges her in that way because she has other features to recommend her. We don't know Mary Washington. And so we've allowed her to be sort of reduced to this caricature.
Well, those letters gave you a different perspective. It was very difficult, I know, to find letters but there were a few that were kind of tucked away that you got to avail yourself of.
Yeah, and you know that – absolutely. And another interesting point about Chernow is he doesn't he includes only the letters where Washington's annoyed. He doesn't include the letters where Washington maybe realizes he was wrong. So, for example, the final thing that everyone says that she did that was so terrible was Mary Washington lived in Virginia, you know, during the war. And Washington was away. She didn't see him for 7 years, and he could be a negligent son. He could be a doting stepfather and husband, but he could be a negligent brother and son. And one of the ways we see this is that, you know, Mary suffered. Like, she really genuinely suffered. And so did a lot of elderly people in Virginia, because this is a war fought on, you know, American soil. That's not quite yet American soil.
We are
Jefferson, in fact. Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I'm sorry. We're coming up on a break, and I just want to, again, invite listeners to join us. You can let us know what your thoughts are about George Washington, but also we're going to talk some more with Alexis Coe. I want to talk with her about, well, the obvious analogies that historians make between George Washington and the man who is now occupying the Oval Office and as president. In many ways, George Washington gave us some caveats and warnings against the misuses of power that certainly hearken to today. You may want to weigh in here, though, and if you do, we want to hear from you. 866-733-6786 is the number to call, or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Alexis Coe, presidential historian, author of You Never Forget Your First, a new biography of President George Washington, and it's a biography that gives us a considerably different picture of George Washington. And I think it's safe to say, because I think Alexis Coe has said this in different ways, that we need to reassess history, because history is mostly here in the United States for men, by men, and about men. But also, she said, history should be fun, and I'm in complete agreement with that. Although there were some serious warnings that came out from Washington, I think, that we need to bring into this discussion, if I may, with you, Alexis Coe, because you do give a mixed picture. You certainly give a picture of some of the, shall we say, humanity that is behind the myths of Washington and some of his flaws and weaknesses, but also a man who was exceptional, had a great deal of dignity and sobriety, and also, as you said earlier, was certainly charismatic. And limited himself to two terms long before it was embedded in the Constitution. But I keep going back, as you do in your book, to the farewell address. And he warned against abuses of power. He warned against all of the norms that, to some extent, some are seeing violated today. In fact, I think you have said in different columns that you've written and things that you have put out there for public consumption that he would have a problem not only with our present president in terms of violations of power, but the Republican Party. And I don't mean this in any partisan way. I suspect you don't either. But everything he feared America would be, to some extent, is our present situation.
Absolutely. It's strange to read the farewell address and not feel a shock of recognition. Taking a step back and looking at his goals, right? It's hard to judge the first president's goals going into office because the goals were to figure out how to be in office, how a president presidents. There was, of course, the Constitution. And there's a great primary source that is his personal copy, Washington's, and he annotates next to things that he thinks are relevant to powers he should have president, in his very beautiful, clear writing. And he one of his greatest fears was partisanship and allowing the republic to become corrupt and decay, because that is what they believed had happened in the British Empire. It took them such a long time to realize that the king knew what was going on in Parliament, because they were sure he doesn't know what's going on. You know, this is just a total mismanagement by men who are obsessed with power. And so one of his goals going into office is that, you know, he wouldn't declare party and he would surround himself with brilliant people who had different opinions. And so that is when he invented, you mentioned terms. The Constitution said 4 years, but didn't say how many. Washington decided 8 years was enough, and everyone followed that until FDR, and that's when it became, you know, codified. But his cabinet was supposed to, this great invention was supposed to manage a lot of these different political agendas and feelings. So it consisted of Thomas Jefferson as Secretary of State, Henry Knox, Secretary of War, Alexander Hamilton, Secretary of Treasury, and Edmund Randolph, Attorney General. But really, we're talking about Jefferson and Hamilton. And Washington would hold cabinet meetings, usually to do with the bank or with foreign influence. And he would think that these were fine discussions, because he would sort of put his general's uniform back on. He would say, OK, they're fighting it out. And at the end, I'm going to hand down my decision and it's all going to be fine. Everyone's going to agree with them. Well, later on, Jefferson would describe these cabinet meetings as, you know, being daily pitted against each other like cocks. So he would talk about it as if it was a blood sport. And then, you know, you have Washington as this referee who's either, you know, forgive the pun, but like waving around dollar bills or yelling at them to go harder at each other. And Jefferson and Hamilton are these razor beak competitors. And of course, that fight spilled out into the streets. And basically gave rise to what we know of as like Fox News and you know, its counterparts. So you have CNN and MSNBC. And these supporters and policy, like everyone was reading these, were reading these newspapers out loud. And the whole country completely turned partisan. And they also were contending with wars and conflicts going on abroad. Remember, we inspired an age of revolutions. You have Thomas Paine hopping from our revolution off to the French Revolution. And a lot of people are thinking we should either get involved with the French Revolution, play both sides. And basically, you know, the French send an ambassador who tries to rally people to join. You know, there's a lot of foreign influence, the attempt at foreign influence, but Washington will never, ever consider it. He won't do any favors. He won't. He, you know, says that he will basically that he issues a neutrality proclamation. And that was brilliant. You know, he doesn't get enough credit for when he would make smart decisions on the battlefield that didn't have to do with battles. Like he understood the court of public opinion. He was a great spy master.
But we should emphasize, though, that unfortunately, as you point out in your book, he left the presidency somewhat heartbroken because of the partisanship.
He did.
And there was a partisanship that came from the cabinet. It was a lot of backstabbing, too.
Absolutely. And so what ended up happening was by creating, you know, this cabinet, he sort of created his partisan nightmare. Half the cabinet's gone by the end of the term. Some stay on. Like Jefferson, by the second term, is basically consulting, but he's done. Washington will not comment. Just like he issues neutrality proclamations, it's better because he can trade. You know, American trade with both the British and the French. But he won't comment on negative stories. Never ever addresses them and won't say ill of anyone who is an elected official.
Well, we have a lot of people who want to talk with you, Alexis. I want to get to some phone calls here. I could go on talking with you all day, but let's see if we can find out what our listeners are thinking or wanting to know. We begin with Michael. Good morning. Michael, you're on the air.
Good morning. So Dr. Koh actually touched on a quite interesting note about Washington and American history there, mentioning that he had essentially triggered off what Americans call the French and Indian War, but is ultimately the Seven Years' War, this huge war in Europe. The irony there is that years later, in order to make back the money that that had cost the British Treasury, the British have to raise taxes across the empire, including in the colonies. And, of course, you get the Americans all, you know, bitching and fetching that King George is raising their taxes to fight his wars, when it's a war that no less a figure than George Washington set off in the first place.
Alexis Koh.
Yes, I mean the irony is amazing. Yeah. And then what's even you know, to sort of take this irony and move into the future when we are a country, what happens during the Whiskey Rebellion, a rebellion that isn't? We need to pay off our debts from the war, and one of the ways that Hamilton has come up with is the central bank is, of course, we've got to tax people, and so he wants to tax whiskey distillers in rural parts of Kentucky and Pennsylvania, and they protest because they don't vote. So no taxation without representation. They don't own land in these parts. You can't vote if you don't own land. And so there's a lot of irony to be found throughout this entire thing. You know, your caller is appreciating these connections. You know, think about if the British had just given Washington the promotion that he wanted, we might be British subjects.
Let me thank the caller, and we're going to go on to another call here. But first, Doug writes, I graduated from Mary Washington College, now the University of Mary Washington in Fredericksburg, Virginia. Hearing all about Mary Washington in a new and different way has been fascinating. Here's Jose. Jose, join us.
Yes, I can't wait to read the author's book, because what she's doing is she's doing something that whenever I've read not just biographies but American history, it's not new that our founding fathers were human and very flawed. They were not just libertarian. They were actually libertines. They were lecherous. They were ambitious. They were just like me, you, and everybody else. They were normal human beings. And to me, that's what makes them more inspiring. If they were paragons of virtue and angel, I'd have nothing to relate to. I wouldn't be able to learn anything from them. But the fact that they were these very flawed human beings, and I'm an immigrant. I wasn't born with my citizenship. I chose it. And I very much admire our system. We have a system which is the envy of the world. And these flawed human beings were able to create that. It's not a perfect system, but it's the best that humanity has to offer.
They were indeed flawed, and Washington is a good example of that. He was a man who did not have wooden teeth, but he had feet of clay. And let me thank you, Jose, for that call. Actually, a listener maybe put you a little on the spot, or Alexis Koh. A listener says, would Washington consider this a time that needs a revolution or a revolutionary presidential candidate?
I can't say I haven't thought that. I mean, he would have been absolutely beside himself about what's going on. You know, again, going back to the farewell address, he warned against foreign influence, and he warned that if we allowed men who cared only about power and not about actually making American lives better to remain in power, that, again, corruption and decay would occur. And so it's hard not to see the parallels that the Republican Party, even if you know, not coming from a partisan perspective, but their reasons for not impeaching don't match up with the reasons that they impeached. You know, in recent memory, we have people who are still in office, McConnell, and you know, we have people who said we're impeaching Clinton for this reason, and they are not applying those same rules. And it does seem like they thwart everything that doesn't, you know, speak to their base or keep their the people who matter to their party in power. And then going back to something that Jose said, it's true, you know, it's funny, the way we got these myths, the wooden teeth, the can't tell lie, all of these things, it was because the first biography was written by an itinerant minister named Parson Weems in 1800. He was like the first guy on the scene, and he wrote this biography that was not really based in reality at all, and has since, if we might disagree on a lot of things, all these historians, but Chernow and I will agree that, you know, Parson Weems is not to be believed. But what he did was he gave America the stories it needed to tell about itself. We had none. We were a new country. We were called an infant nation in this world of countries that had been around for hundreds of years. And so we needed to make ourselves into something we were proud of, you know, that we believed in. Not just that we had won this war and we had had sort of this toughness. We needed to have morals and values. And since then, what has happened, you know, and by the way, Mary Washington, when we needed this great mother, at first in the 1800s, her character was unimpeachable. Everyone thought that she was, you know, the perfect American mother, the ideal. And that changed over time. But this idea of the founders as perfect, even though we have so much to suggest that they not only found themselves imperfect, each other, and wanted us to judge them and continually, you know, challenge the legacy and challenge what we know to believe in our country. You know, they're presented as these perfect people. And I think that I think there's a lot of fear in there in that presentation. There's a lot of defensiveness. My point has been, you know, George Washington is just fine. He's beyond being canceled. You know, there's no way to really enervate his legacy in a way that will have that sort of grand consequence.
Well, there are some who are suggesting because he was a slave owner, you shouldn't have schools named after him, for example. I mean, there has been an attempt to sort of push
there
back.
There has been. But I mean, that doesn't – if there's – whether or not, you know, one school doesn't have his name, another one usually will pop up in its place. It's not going to change that George Washington was the great general who won the Revolution and he was our first president. And his history will never be, you know, erased. It can only be complicated in a way that's beneficial to us because we inherited his legacy. So much of this country is based on who he is. So if we understand his hypocrisies and his complexities and the beautiful parts and the truly horrifying ones, then we can better understand our country because we still see that legacy today.
Again, our guest is Alexis Coe, presidential historian, author of You Never Forget Your First, a new biography of George Washington. A listener writes, I wouldn't read too much contemporary dog worship in a Washington dog's name, Sweet Lips. I'll bet the dog was a foxhound and that the name refers to the dog's voice in the hunt field. Let me get another caller aboard here, and let me go next to Mary. Mary, you're on. Good morning. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, hi. Good morning. Listen, I just want to know, first of all, I'm an African-American woman, a mother, and when my son was in high school, he had to do a research paper on George Washington. And he and his teacher discovered that George Washington had a black strategist, a war strategist, and I was wondering whether or not your author had encountered anything as such and had put anything to that in her book.
Alexis Coe?
There are several black men who are enslaved who play roles during the Revolution that are important. There are spies, and I think that's probably who you're referring to. There's, of course, his right-hand man, Billy Lee, who's talked about a lot. You know, I don't think a strategist quite as much, but, you know, we can never really quantify how important spying is because the whole point is you keep it a secret. But we do know that it was definitely commented on quite often abroad in the UK that you know, we hadn't outfought them, but we had outspied them. And so, you know, Washington, it wasn't just people of color, you know, enslaved people, whoever. He was willing to use whoever he could during the war, even if it meant, you know, enslaved soldiers, although he tried to avoid that for a long time because, of course, he is fundamentally a Southerner and he's a plantation owner and the last thing they want to do is arm slaves. But, you know, he also relied on women who kept boarding houses in Virginia and in Virginia and also Philadelphia, and women who put out clothes on a clothesline in order to signal something, that they had a message in Setauket on Long Island. And so he definitely relied on whoever he could. And then after the war, was very happy to see them back in their places.
I had a question from a listener named Michael who wants to know how much of the couple's wealth came from Martha Washington. I know a great deal of it did, but also, did Washington actively manage Mount Vernon while he was president, or did he delegate?
That's a good question. And also, going back to Sweet Lips, that was one of the very silly names he gave his dogs. But we also have Drunkard, Miss Moose. It goes on and on. It's not just Sweet Lips. It's sort of incredible for a man who was known for being stern. When Washington was away, both at war and then at the presidency, he left various people in charge of his property. The most famous during the Revolution is Lund Washington, his cousin, and he would write back all the time. And the way that this is presented by his past biographers who do, when I say, you know, male biographers, it's because there are literally hundreds to three women. I'm the third, and I'm the only trained historian among them. It's a journalist and a travel writer. And I'm the only one in the last 40 years. So it is significant. You know, when his biographers will present these letters about Mount Vernon, it's very whimsical, and it's romantic and idealized. You know, he's writing about it's his escape from the pressures at hand, but he's writing about the enslaved population because that's a major part of his business, and so he's definitely on top of it when he's away.
Now, you grew up in California, right?
I did. I grew up in L.A.
Well, I only raise that because I got a listener sending in an email asking, how did growing up in California influence your work?
It's interesting. You know, I grew up in L.A. and then I lived in San Francisco for a few years. And I think about myself as a Californian in the way that I was raised with our history. You know, I did a mission project. I was raised with the gold rush. You know, those were the relics that surrounded me. And the men who write about Washington tend to be of a certain mold. They are white. They are older men who grew up near these battlefields, whether they're revolutionary or civil war. They visited Mount Vernon as a young man, and you know, now they research among people who look like them. And to come from California to have you know, learned about Washington in my textbooks, but I feel like I probably know more about the Spanish California, Alta California, than I learned about, you know, George Washington during my education. I when I came to live on the East Coast for grad school and then stayed for various jobs, I think it really struck me how ingrained founding history was in their education and in this veneration. And I think that because I didn't grow up with it, and because I again feel like my personal opinions about the founders aren't really relevant. It doesn't even seem professional to really talk about it.
Yeah, but you're on your way to changing the veneration for another generation.
Yeah, that I was able to look at things with a fresh eye. And I do think there is a bit of a California spirit, a sort of gold rush spirit, where you feel like, okay, I'm going to pretend that everything is – I'm starting anew. You know, this is day one, and we're going to clear the slate and make it what we want. That is certainly, I think, a real gold rush quality that we all get.
And let me bring more callers aboard here. Marty, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. There was a book by Mary Beth Norton reviewed in the Wall Street Journal on Saturday on the year 1774, and one of the criticisms made of the book in the journal was the fact that it didn't deal with the question of whether part of the motivation for the revolution was an attempt to retain slavery since the British had outlawed it. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mentioned that in the book, you know, a little bit like Washington and the other founders, and a lot of them are Virginians, Jefferson, Madison, Washington, they owned slaves and they owned huge plantations. And obviously the way that they made them profitable was through slave labor. And also, let's jump ahead to the end of the revolution and part of the conflict between the North and the South with the central bank and like where should the capital of the United States be? It had to do with the fact that the Southerners had paid off their war debts and they didn't want to assume the North's debts. How were they able to do that? Slave labor. So I'm saying all this because it is important to remember that even though they don't talk about the fact that this was starting to change, and certainly in London it was no, you know, very recently no longer legal, we don't know how much they worried about it, but we do know it was as much of an affront to them, as much of they felt like telling them how to run their lives and their business as it was, you know, that they couldn't negotiate a price when tobacco left, you know, the colonies and made its way to London. The price was determined in London without any say from them. They couldn't set the prices for anything. They got charged on all their – you know, it's this no representation thing. But we don't know, but we do know that they were aware of it. And I mention it when I talk about, you know, the days leading up to Boston, you know, after Lexington and Concord, because it's really important to remember that it was always at the forefront of their minds. This is their worldview. When they look outside, they see hundreds of enslaved people. And so I think it is a valid criticism. I don't think that you can really write a new book and not at least mention that. And I also think we can't talk about plantations anymore in these romantic ways that are full of nostalgia, swelling with these, you know, scenes from Gone with the Wind. We really need to talk about them for what they were, which is, yes, it was a plantation. It was a mansion house. It had, you know, places that the Washingtons would stroll and do other things that we imagine people did during this time. But it was a forced labor camp. Hundreds of people lived there in dire conditions with clothes that barely covered their bodies, and they were hungry, and they had no rights and no autonomy.
It's interesting that the President of the United States recently, soured on the idea that Parasite should have won so many Academy Awards and brought up Gone with the Wind. He said, why don't we have a film like Gone with the Wind again? A lot of historians and like yourself and others have made a great deal out of that in terms of deconstructing it. But in the meantime, let me get another caller on here, and that's Danny. Danny, you're on. Morning.
Hey, good morning. I have a comment and a question. First, I want to say I'm really excited to read the book. And I wanted to just comment and ask about factions and about how Washington maybe felt about a certain issue. I heard you compare CNN, MSNBC, you know, against Fox News. But recently I heard Chris Matthews compare Bernie's victory to the Nazi blitzkrieg into Belgium and France. Now, it seems like there's a real faction divide between the, like, a capitalist class and the working class. After reading a book like The Wages of Whiteness, I see that there was a class divide even then between slavery and an immediate war separating working people together. How does factionalism then compare to today versus this conflict between the working class and the ruling class? And do we have organizations really supporting the working class?
It's a good question, Danny. Thank you for it. Let me go back to Alexis Coe. Alexis Coe.
That's a really good question. It's a complicated question.
Yeah.
I think factionalism was intense and you know, arguably, I've been on tour for a few weeks now, and I've had the privilege of having conversations with great thinkers of our time. For example, Noah Feldman, who testified before Congress. He's a professor at Harvard. And he was saying, you know, he asked a similar question, and he made a statement before he asked it. And he said, you know, what we see today is nothing compared to early America. And I don't know if I disagree. You know, I can give you an example from
the book. Could I just come
in
here with something that you write a great deal about? The frenemies.
Yes. Yes, I was just going to say, yes, I compare all the people I named in the, you know, all the founders, you know, and all the people I named at the beginning, and I call them frenemies. And I have I talk about this throughout the book, but I also talk about this. I have a chart at the beginning of the presidency section. And it's because I want you to know about factionalism. I'll walk you through the Whiskey Rebellion and the central bank and all that stuff. But I want you to know how very different it was for Washington coming into office and then leaving. And, you know, on the other end of the spectrum, we'll get to the Bolton version of his tell-all that came from James Monroe. But, you know, before Washington became president, he was sort of untouchable. You know, he described it as going to his funeral, but everyone venerated him. He was the only guy for the job. And then after, he was estranged from Jefferson, from Madison, from Monroe. And if I may just read two quotes, you know, I have the quotes from all these guys from the beginning and the end, but Thomas Paine, you know, he was the best writer. So let's just go with him. Before Washington became president, he said, "I shall never suffer a hint of dishonor or even deficiency of respect to you to pass unnoticed." So that's Thomas Paine on Washington before he became president. And here's Thomas Paine on Washington after he became president. "As to you, sir, treacherous in private friendship, for so you have been to me, and that in the day of danger, and a hypocrite in public life, the world will be puzzled to decide whether you're an apostate or an impostor, whether you have abandoned good principles, or whether you ever had any."
Wow. The contrast
Serious
is extraordinary.
Burn.
Yeah, what a chasm.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
well,
I would say it's just as bad.
Well, we're coming to the end of this hour. What particularly do you want people to know about George Washington? I think it's been implicit in this conversation that he was a flawed and complex and multidimensional human being, and that there was a lot of paradox and certainly a lot to, still to learn.
So most biographies end on the emancipation of his slaves, and they do that because they want this redemption story. They want him to go out strong, but I go past it because I need us to understand the complexities that I've already explained. But I don't want to end there. I want to end on his inheritance. And so if I can quote myself, you know, after Washington died, he wanted to be buried at home, and he had this vault in mind. He didn't get to finish it, so it took a while, and he doesn't end up there, even though he died in 1799. He doesn't end up being interred in his vault at Mount Vernon until 1831. And of course, you know, he has a different casket because he means a big thing. You know, at that point, the legacy building has already begun. He's the Great Seal of the United States. And then the Civil War happens, and Confederate and Union soldiers carve their initials into the walls of the vault that he had recently been moved to.
I'm afraid we have to leave it there, Alexico. Like I said,
yeah.
I would welcome the opportunity.
He belongs to all of us.
For hours.
Yeah.
But let's let it end with those words. He belongs to all of us.
Yeah.
I like that. Thank you so much for joining us. The book again.
Thank you. It was wonderful.
You Never Forget Your First, a new biography of George Washington. Next hour, all about immigration. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.